This is Ken Stringfellow of the Posies, Big Star, etc., and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acre.
WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have an old one you don't need and it is either a Macintosh 2011 or newer, 2.0 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, or Windows 2012 or newer, 2.4 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, email info@wgxc.org for more information.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXE sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Hello, and welcome tonight to Race Talks with me, Kimberly Y. Irwin. Here on WGXC 90.7 FM, every third Tuesday of the month at 7 p.m., is where me and my guest talkers come together to have the very necessary conversations on race and ethnicity. Today's main topic is how wisdom can be a powerful tool to ending racism. And we have a guest talker today, Dr. Mark Cooper, whose business is to do just that, utilize wisdom in one's life. However, this is May, and May is an affinity month, just like we celebrated in February, Black History Month. This month is themed Asian Pacific Islander American Month, or one would say Heritage Awareness Month. And there's so many other terms like Asian Pacific American, APA, or Pacific Islanders, AAPI. So there's so many different terms to really recollect on how Asian descent, those from Asian descent in the United States who are Americans, are viewed. And that's why we have Affinity Months, to show our affinity, our interest, and our support and love for those people of different cultures or different ethnicities, or who may have originated from different nationalities on different parts of the globe that we all share on Earth. I like to say one world, and that's who we are. So I want to really talk initially, before I introduce my guest, Dr. Mark Cooper, in about 10 minutes, is really, why do we look at Heritage Months and why is it important? And I'm coming from an educator standpoint, because this month, like I mentioned, Black History Month is really an important time to reflect on the identities of those who have come before us and who have made America a great nation that we are able to enjoy their work, their hard efforts. And one of the things that Asian Americans, I'll keep it short, because again, there's different terminologies, API, APA, AAPI. So I'm just going to go with the easier, smaller term, Asian awareness, Asian American Awareness Month. And we know from the past that Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, and have created created America by using their efforts at building railroads, at creating commerce, at helping with the industrialization of America. But there's also times before this land was actually considered America that Asian populations were important to the landmass that we consider North America. So I won't go into the entire history, but I really wanted to come, like I said, from the standpoint of an educator. Once we educate, and I think when Mark comes on, Dr. Cooper comes on, he will also be able to share more information about how knowledge can lead into wisdom, but it's not the same thing. We in school, as educators, we help young people with knowledge in giving them information that they can then use to forward their behavior and their goals in life. So being that this is an Affinity Awareness Month, I'd like to talk more about what organizations can be utilized for that fact. So if there's educators on the line, and parents, you two are educators, and people in the community, a neighbor can be an educator of youth too. So when you go online and you Google things, one of the things that comes up that I've used in a classroom when I taught was the Joshua Project. And what it does is it looks at groupings of affinity groups in the world. And I just wanted to bring that screen up so that I can read some of the information that was forwarded by this Joshua Project. And one of the things that you can notice, well, I'm just going to read a few, and then I'm going to act like it's a classroom setting, and I'm going to ask you a question. Not that I'll be able to hear you, but you will know what your thoughts are. So as an affinity block, he lists in the Joshua Project, the Arab world, East Asian peoples, Eurasian peoples, Horn of Africa peoples, Latin Caribbean Americans, Malay peoples, North American peoples, Pacific Islanders, South Asian peoples, Southeast Asian peoples, Sub-Saharan peoples. And then he has a place for Turkic peoples and unclassified. And when I look at this, I have a certain thought that comes to my mind. And I think, what is he really grouping here? So when you look at these terms, if you're familiar with the globe, you recognize that it's not exactly what we would consider affinity in America, but these are groupings that we look at land masses, right? When we look at Eurasian people or people from East Asia, we're looking at the globe and where the land masses and where people settled and the titles we give these places. What we're not noticing, however, is anything to do with skin color or skin tone. So how did we in America really come to look at affinity groups with terms that tell us what our the skin make, the color or the hue of our skin is? And that's really what we talk about here on Race Talks. It's not really race that we're looking at, but ethnic differences, ethnic and cultural norms that are developed over time based on where we populate on the planet Earth. That's really what we're looking at. And I thought it was really interesting how the Joshua Project did group those peoples. One of the reasons I wanted to highlight also Asian Americans this month is because of the hate that has been proliferating in communities. And since I don't have an Asian person, a person of Asian descent on the show today, I thought I will share their words by what is written from them or from a member of that group. And one of the members wrote about her experience. And I will read that, which is an excerpt coming out of an article that I found. Actually, it was recommended to me. The person I am going to read her words is Elizabeth Kleinrock, who is an educator, and she's currently working on her first book. She's the 2018 recipient of the Teaching Tolerance Award for Excellence in Teaching. Before I actually read what she said, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Teaching Tolerance Group, because the terminology teaching tolerance is a little bit out of tune. So they actually changed their wording. So it's no longer the Teaching of Tolerance Organization, but the Learning for Justice Organization. And we see this summer, and Mark and I, when we talked about his coming on the show, and he will bring this up a little bit later, is the amount of advocacy, the amount of justice-leaning activities that started more recently that started over the summer. And we know that as educators, as people of the community, we need to come together and support any group, any member that is being unduly treated unfairly or being or having crimes committed against them, specifically due to their nation of origin or their terminology or their affinity groups. So she writes, or she says, "Since I awoke to the headline, 6 Asians shot and killed in Georgia, I haven't been able to eloquently express my sadness, frustration, and rage. As an Asian American educator, how could I face my students in class when my body and voice are noticeably shaking? When I'm angry, I tend to channel my emotion into my work. In Korean culture, there's a term called Han, which is also my Korean surname. Han represents a shared connection amongst Koreans. It's sorrow, anger, but most importantly, resilience. I can't change the past, no one can, but what I can do in this moment is direct these emotions into action to take one step towards ensuring that no Asian child is called Kung Flu by a classmate, and that my students will not grow up to harass and attack people of Asian descent on the street. The first step is anti-bias work, and that helps to identify the bias. If we truly intend to center our students, we have to ask ourselves, am I engaging my students in the inquiry process by allowing their questions to guide their own learning? And even taking a step back to consider, what questions am I asking my students? We can't fix what we don't know is broken. And we certainly know that we have turned the page on what we consider as a nation, Asian American inheritance. And they went from being the model minority in textbooks and in political conversations via the television and on radio talk shows, to now this topic that seems to be identified by a group of haters, mainly due to what we found here today, or what we're finding in this period of time that lasts now more than a year of COVID-19 pandemic living. So I want to bring in my guest today for his introduction, because when we do talk to students, we are asking them about their the knowledge that they have, and we're helping them gain more information and more knowledge, but it's not wisdom, right? So I want to introduce my guest talker, Dr. Mark B. Cooper, right now, and he's going to share, because I can talk about him all day. He has such a very long resume, but I want him to share with my audience initially exactly what he brings to the table in his workforce and a little bit about him personally that he would feel comfortable opening up to the audience. So Mark, Dr. Mark Cooper, welcome to Race Talks. Please introduce yourself to our guest tonight. I mean, as my guest tonight.
I'm privileged to be your guest tonight because I think this is a conversation that most people don't have. So I've learned something from you right from the very beginning. I saw something that I've never seen before, and I've been around a while. And so you've given me a viewpoint about something that adds to my knowledge and makes me smarter about how I see myself in this particular domain. So I really thought about this since your invitation came to me. First of all, my daughter's Chinese, so thank you.
Oh, what? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yep, and so that's wonderful because, and I'm Jewish, so, you know, we have a ethnicity issue too. Mm-hmm. But I think what might be missing on the front end is an acknowledgement that you folks are getting it done because I'm here. People are talking about it. It's on people's minds, not everybody's mind. So it's you know, inches, not yards. And I'm different being engaged because of what you've done. Black Lives Matter changed who I am.
Oh, before you start and share more of that, which is going to be wonderful, tell everyone who you are.
Oh, I'm just a guy.
There's
a teacher I had, and Joseph Campbell, and he once said, if you see your steps clearly on the path, it's the wrong path. So when people say, you know, who are you and what, you know, what have you done? I've done a lot of stuff. You know, I'm a doctor, so I've done the professional side of the coin. I've been a consultant. I've been a coach. I've been a writer. I've been a blogger. I've been an observer. And I've been, most importantly, a human being and beginning to recognize my flaws and be responsible for them. So, you know, I'm just figuring it out just like everybody else. Wisdom doesn't give you the answer, I can tell you that. I've been a seeker of that for a while. Wisdom just gives you more questions. So the first question I ask myself is, maybe they're right. Maybe I am a systemic racist and I never looked there. So that was a kind of wake-up call for me because that terminology actually was, from a medical side, is like, whoa, I know what systemic means. It's also cellular. It's also, you know, DNA-ish. So that was interesting. So it's been a really a good process for me. It's like, oh, man. The second thing I learned that you said, besides masses of, you know, I really distinguished something I hadn't seen before, was reflection, that you asked everyone to reflect on what you said. And you, if you want to look at the real answer to racism, that you've answered it. People need to be able to reflect. And boy, that is a tough fight to get people to really think about it. And you're doing probably a remarkable job. So those two things were worth my time being with you. So I thank you for doing that. Any other questions that you have? I assume you have plenty.
Well, it doesn't seem like you're going to really share any of your bio. but definitely, good observation.
Personal. I'll share more of myself.
That's really great. So I'm going to let you share your bio as it organically, if it comes up. How's that?
I don't think I am my bio.
No, we are our bios, but I think our bios can represent some part of the path that we have traveled. Yeah, in our life.
Well, when you're 76 years old like me, there's a lot of signs I've passed. So when someone says, tell me your bio, it's like, I don't know. It seems like old socks or something.
I haven't lived as long as you, but I like the fact that you too have so many dimensions to your existence. You know, I'm an educator. I taught high school English. I'm a writer, a journalist, international journalist. Author, I can continue, right?
No, and we met okay.
Because you also have a podcast.
I do Yes, I do. Most of my focus, okay, I'll get a little bit more specific. That might be helpful for the audience. Thank you for your coaching. My focus is on healthcare, because that's another area. I'm sure there's some limitations on the speech I can use here, but it's pretty effed up. I mean, to realize that 35 million Americans, the healthcare system doesn't work. And it could work a lot better. And it's the intermediaries aren't able to effectively combine their talent to make it work more holistically. And so that's what I've been working on for a while. And so where most of my focus has been is the people, the stakeholders in healthcare, and trying to figure that out. And it's not an easy thing to figure out. But they're getting smarter and smarter and smarter, and, you know, artificial intelligence. So I've had some of those companies on my lines. We've really taken a look at how do you make sure that you're doing the right thing at the right time, at the right cost, and all that stuff. So trying to make the system more efficient. So that's part of my background. And then I coach executives on not making mistakes, I coach executives on how to be with their mistakes is a much more accurate way to say that. Because a mistake gives you a new future if you handle it right. So I look from that perspective with the executives I work with, and I do what you do. I blog about what I'm passionate about, and I write about what I'm passionate about, and I try to change people's minds, because probably it's probably my karma. It's like, I listened to a Ram Dass audiobook, which just is, for me, nurturing. And what he says, you got karma. And he talked about karma. What he said about karma is you can't change it. You're going to have to love it or you can't hate it. You have to, it's your karma. And for me, my karma is being a teacher. So I understand that part of you. And I appreciate that too, by the way.
Well, thank you. And thank you for sharing that much about yourself as a background. I like the fact that you mentioned that, you know, being a doctor and having the period of time that we're living in as a pandemic. One of the things that I was talking to some of my friends about maybe 10 years ago, so definitely pre-pandemic, pre-COVID-19 pandemic anyway, was racism as a disease. So there's a disease, the word disease, you know, together, and being not at ease or dis-ease, you know? So either way, racism is, you know, of being systemic in our culture, because what's systemic, like what's the bones and, you know, the sinews of our flesh is in a capitalistic system, power and wealth.
Yes.
And that's what racism is.
I can say yes.
Power to achieve wealth.
It's an extremely complex issue with a tremendously long history, and even some probably psychodemographics of what you talked about, but also physiologic. I mean, racism has been around for a long time. And what you happen to be manifesting it at this time, but there are other periods if you look at history. And so one of the things that I appreciate about getting old, by the way, I want to talk, that's one of the things, is that, you know, the elderhood is not respected in our culture. So I'm running into ageism. So it's like, oh, you know, I don't, you know, the guy's too old. You know, I doubt it though. There's just so much wisdom that isn't being accessed. I mean, you could look at politics, you could look at any thing today in terms of how it functions. And if you saw the power of wisdom and what it could do, and how it could change the relationship that people have with their problems and the people around them. Do you think a wise person would be causing war anywhere on the planet? It's like, well, you know, where is wisdom? And so there's a big job to do for me. It's like wisdom gives you contemplation and reflection, and more importantly, it gives you responsibility. And that's, you know, it's like, oh man, you know, maybe I had something to do with this. Just like I said, maybe I'm a systemic racist. I never looked at that. So that's what I'm talking about, reflection. You have really hit all the nails. You've hit the nails on the head. And I don't know, you know, I do what I can do in service to that.
Well, let me ask you, when you say reflection, and I'm staying with the theme of racism as a disease. When we are, you mentioned wisdom, and that why would we, you know, blow up our planet? Why would we and why are we doing these unwise things for the furthering of humanity, even? And so
I'm totally agreeing with you. I wouldn't put it quite in that context, but yeah, I mean, there's something. Human beings are just interesting species. If you came from another planet and looked at them, you go, wow, where did they come from? What was that about? You know, hate is such a stupid thing because it gets there's no return on investment in hating somebody. That only took me 55 years to learn. So, you know, wisdom comes a little bit slow and, you know, a little patience is missing. And for most people who are activists like you and the Black Lives Matter folks, it's great. Gets us moving, but we don't move as fast as you. And so, you know, it's a little patience here, but we're coming. I think that you're making an impact. Life is changing for me, for my neighborhood, for the people I speak with, for the other. I being Jewish and white, I got away with a lot. If I had a brown skin, it'd be pretty tough on me. But, we knew how to sneak in and make money and get out. So we're pretty good. You know, we're really good now. We just lost $6 million in the cost. That was a little bit of a problem. I just want to acknowledge, if I could, if this is about race talks, I want to talk to the race that you're speaking to and say, this is a marathon. And you're gaining ground. You're doing well. People are looking at themselves a little bit more as a responsible agent in how the whole and what you're talking about here about race. So I think, hey man, congratulations. You're changing me.
Well, in many professions now, I believe we're looking at systemic racism in every nuance or facet in our professional lives. So when you look at politics, when you look at the major institutions, education, government, law enforcement has come, you know, rarely in the public arena for that kind of a discussion. I know in our community, here in Greene and Columbia counties, we have just come from having a community-wide discussion on social justice issues. And
let me ask a question. Now.
Well, let me just finish this one statement. In this area, we are predominantly of European American or white, lighter-skinned, hued people. And they have made it a forefront. So when I'm hearing you speak, it's you're sort of looking at different groups as different cultures, but you're also saying that it's we're all in this together. Is that what I'm hearing you saying?
It was interesting. You institutionalized racism. You mentioned all the things that aren't working. The police, the corporate, you went all the way up the line. And I think that's fine to look because it exists there as an expression. But the thing you failed to mention was human being. We're not looking at ourselves. That, you know, like really take a good look. There's a benefit and a cost. there's a benefit to being a racist and there's a cost to being a racist.
And the cost, and well, I will agree with that. And I think, you know, from politics, one with what they did in law recently, the Supreme Court, who are people, stated that corporations are people too, right? So when we do look at whole groups or institutions, we recognize that there are people behind them. However, many of the people who form these institutions, and why we say it's institutionalized, need not be around any longer to further the actions that happens within the walls or the within the vessels of these institutions. So the people who started them are gone, and yet the sinews remain fresh even to continue to bring forth whatever the culture was. So exactly. Is it hate? Is it, you know, hate based on wanting to have wealth? I liken that to when someone mentions, you know, why are you getting mad at me? I didn't own any slaves, right? So so if you didn't own any slaves, then you don't have, you're not, you're, there's no culpability. And the idea, I would say, as a proper response would be, the fact that when you benefit from deleterious behavior, then you are part of that. You've consumed it. And that's part of being institutionalized. When the people consume that which was gained in a manner that was...
And then you could go a layer above that, which is, you know, context is decisive. You can go that they're only responding to something above them, whatever that is, could be the stock market, but they're responding to something above that. And then the stock market is responding to something above that. Where you can make your change is with people, and people will change things. And I work a lot in these business cultures, and I just want you to know that human beings are pretty good people. I mean, the people I've met, they want to do right. They don't know how to be right. And that's a whole different story. That's an ontologic conversation about how I'm relating to the world, because how I see the world is how I act in the world. That's how it works. And so if I see the world differently, I see not only the world, I see the people in the world differently. So it's one of the things that I think is really important, is that we can change ourselves, because our history really isn't terminal. And but it's going to take some work. And I don't know if people are willing to do the work. I know that people around me that I talk to need to do the work. And so we do work. We work on ourselves and find out, well, how did you come to this place in your life? And why does it look the way it does? And why do you look at others that way? What's that? And so we begin to explore who we are, and who we are as the determinant of what we observe. And what we observe, if you live in a quantum world, for example, what we observe is the thing turns out to be that reality. So why do we do it? Why are we doing that? What is that about? So my view is not to change the institution, it's to change the people in the institution and to have them look at themselves as cause in the matter. Like, okay, if you're creating this, why are you doing that? And that's an interesting question, because it puts responsibility right in the heart of the matter. It's like, okay, you're causing the world to look this way. What are you getting out of that? And people that don't like to look there. But that's
so what I'm hearing you saying, and again, one of the reasons why I thought it was really great for you to be on the show is because though you are or have been in many different professions, you are looking at business professionals and sharing information that is sort of existential about who a person might be and how they become that person, and how maybe in the case of coaching that you do, that they can, I'm going to just use this word, heal themselves, so to speak.
Well said. I think I'll use you for marketing. That was that was great.
Well, I'm saying that because when you mention people, I'm from mainly, although I've done lots of other things, I'm mainly an educator. I remember teaching a person at when I was 12 years old something in math that their parent gave me $3 an hour to help a son do that. And I was like, yay. So when people are washing dishes and mowing lawns for money, I'm actually teaching, grade level math. But so I look at the institution of education and how one might go about affording the knowledge, the information to young people to get them to change. Because I know when I was in school in the 80s, we had food fights based on our race and ethnicity.
I went to school before Martin Luther King. So, you know, it was like, I've been around a while. I've watched in a different way than being in the middle of it. Because until recently, I was not fully responsible for the way I saw the way things were going.
And that's what I wanted you to share, because you mentioned in the beginning about you possibly being a racist.
No, it's not possible. I am systemic. I grew up in it. It was water to the fish, air to the bird. That was the culture. It was unsaid words, but always existed. It was nuanced in a way. It was where I lived. It was where I went to school. It was everywhere. And I never had a question about it. It was just the way it was. So I had no willingness to look from the point of view of that I'm somewhat responsible for that happening. My first experience of really being more racially aware was when I went to dental school. I had to live in North Philadelphia because that's where the dental school was located. And that was not a wonderful neighborhood. That was not where I grew up. And it was like, holy shit, you know. So I felt fear coming up through me that I was unwilling to recognize as, you know, something because of the viewpoint that I had of where I was, of the people around me.
Now, let me ask you, for my audience's sake, who aren't familiar with North Philly, why would you be afraid? I went to school in Philly.
Well, I was, you know, if I went to the Apollo Theater in the 60s when you went to school, I would be the only white face in that audience.
Okay. So I just wanted to make it clear the reason why you're experiencing fear that was spoken. Okay.
So, but, you know, over time, you know, then things, people have different relationships occur. And one for me was in one of my professional trainings, I became a best friend of, and they didn't have a skin color after about a month. They were just Robert. And that was like, oh, you know what? Maybe I was seeing it in a wrong way. But then I also moved that into a particular viewpoint of a certain kind of African-American. It wouldn't be this kind of African-American.
Right. I want to interrupt you there because I know that me and several people that, everyone that basically who has black skin, who have experienced being in a school of predominantly others, being told at one time or informed that you're not like the others. So when you said that Robert, what was going through my head anyway, when you mentioned Robert, as not having any longer a skin color for you, in my mind, I went, oh, so he became different than those others.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Which in itself is a racist thought.
Exactly.
Because it's formed in bias. Your understanding is central and right, and everyone else's viewpoint is other.
Something like that. But I think one of the aspects of this thing about racism, getting it resolved and having people be responsible and beginning to reflect on their responsibility in this matter, there's a lot of finger pointing going on and everybody's responsible. Mm-hmm. You're causing the matter. There's some behaviors that ought to be checked out by the people going, you know, why are the white folks looking at me like that? What could I do? Rather than go, you know, I think it's all okay. It's moving in the right direction. But, you know, there's a kind of speaking that would be really open up the door a little bit more, like, you know, we want to work it out and we probably had something to do with the way you're reacting to us. What do we need to do to get this thing more, the distance closed? So well, that conversation is missing for me. It's like, okay, where is that conversation happening? There are people sitting down and talking like that.
Well, let me ask you, because there has been conversation recently, specifically in the last administration under Trump, where information has come about. I mean, it's always been there, but people are now talking about it more so, where there have been African-American communities that were very much vigorous and wanting and achieving a status for themselves so that they can, not for the purpose of being seen as regular or normal or culturally non-distinct from the major culture, but then was torn down, destroyed. You know, there was a what one would call one called Black Wall Street in town and cities in some states. So when I think, and that's why I love talking and specifically to you, because we have talked before, but I'm saying this mainly for an audience who's probably someone back there, someone listening is saying, I wish you would mention this. So I'm mentioning it only so we can converse more about it. The fact that the onus isn't really on Black behavior, right? Because in any culture, in every culture, and in this month we're looking at or celebrating Asian Pacific Islander American heritage, is that in any family, and I'll say these affinity groups are families. So in any family, you have all everyone on the line, everyone on a continuum. You know, in any family, you're going to have the person who's the Black sheep. You're going to have the person who's the do-gooder, the person who's, you know, loves everyone, the person who's a hater, the person who's a comedian. You're going to have all groups, like in a classroom, if you have a class that's big enough, right? So as a community, a family, you're going to have them all. So in an African-American community, you'll have those who may not be the norm of behavior, you know, the best of behavior, but you'll have some that are great. But when a community, but that's a majority who owns promotional material, who owns the media, who owns everything, they put on a picture or they put out a picture of a small minority of that group. And so it's hard to say, I agree with what you're saying that every, you know, they're not all great people in every group, but when the showcase was on those that are negative, then it's hard for then those groups to come around and say, you know, we are not that great. We're going to put our best foot forward. We're not going to really look at maybe those who need more help and are definitely, you know, in need of guidance and aren't doing their best, because each group has them. So we don't want to proliferate that small group, because it's not the largest group of African-American population or any other population.
We need to move to a level of human being to human being, not of all the stuff that is between us. It is a journey. It is not something you have a light switch to turn on, given the millennial years that we have been through all of this. We survived this. We survived by tribes. That's how we got to be alive on the planet today. And so that's been, you know, a while that we have been in our tribes. And some tribes have won, some tribes have lost, some tribes have been enslaved. Some, you know, it's all there. You are making a difference. It is changing. It physically is making a difference. People are conscious now, much more conscious than I was in the 50s and 60s, I can tell you, and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, 5 years ago. We're here. Okay, let's, you know, you and I are talking. This is a great conversation to be had by people. It's like, you know, maybe it's time we figure out how to talk to each other and stop talking to, you know, within in our own bubble. That doesn't make any difference. All you do is get to be right in your own bubble. We don't need to be right. We need to, you know, get this thing. What you said was brilliant. We lived in a world that was geophysically determined, and we lived there for a very long time, Europeans and Africans and South America, you know, all that. And we all got to be the kind of people that we are living in those areas. But now we're global. Mm-hmm. We no longer are local. We are no longer tribe. How do you live well in a heterogeneous world? How do we do that? That's a much better question to be in. Okay.
I will agree with that. And you mentioned something earlier that you had a daughter who is of Chinese descent.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, she's amazing.
Yeah, can you, you don't have to go too far into that, but.
Oh, I can go for it.
Okay, so since you're not of Chinese descent, how did that come about?
I was working for an all-women's consulting company. And we were working out of Hong Kong, and I was working in, and their hospital system is based on the English hospital system. So it was pretty sophisticated. It was Hong Kong at that time before it was the Chinese took it over. And she wanted to adopt a baby, but she was gay. And so you needed a man to make this thing happen. And I was the only man in the firm at that moment in time. So I did not volunteer. I went to China, and it was wonderful. I mean, you know, we had our separate rooms, and she was great. And, you know, but I went to the people that signed the things and all that stuff. But we went out to the orphanage to get this young lady's daughter. And so it was mostly women, mostly girls, and they were all under 6 months, and there was no glass in the windows.
Oh, wow.
And then there were these cribs that were all metal that were lined up edge to edge to edge for rows. And there wasn't the thing that got me, there wasn't a sound. You know, you would figure with 90 babies, there would be some not a sound.
Wow.
And I walk out of there and I go, what can I do? And we went through the process of figuring out what to do and getting interviewed and all that stuff. And there's companies that actually mitigate the whole transfer that happened, at least at the era that we have. She's now 27.
Oh, wonderful.
She is a digital magical woman. She fixed my phone. You know, I'm one of those.
I'm going to be really, really bad here. She was a model minority. No, just joke. I'm not joking.
I asked her about that. I said, well, we live in Portland, which is the insanity of the world. But, you know, there are a lot of Asians in the Northwest, so she feels somewhat comfortable, more comfortable than she would live in North Carolina.
Okay.
So, you know, I keep in touch. I get more worried than, you know, how parents are. I get more worried than she is. You know, where are you going tonight and all that stuff.
Is that because of the time like you're boyfriend. Living in or?
Say again, I'm sorry.
Is it because of the time, you said you're getting more worried because she's 27. So you're saying that you're more worried, you're worried about her more than she's worried. Is that because of the times we're living in?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Hate crimes?
Okay. I don't think there's a level of concern that goes on for at least for me, and I'm sure most parents who have kids that are Asian about, or kids that are Black, or, you know, what I mean, you, for the whole world about, you know, exactly what to do when you're driving a car.
Right.
How to live like that. How to live in fear when you're going from, you know, it just doesn't work.
I think that's why when I brought that up, because what you were saying is you were identifying yourself, rightly so. I mean, I wrote a book that basically first step of healing yourself or overcoming racism is to understand yourself and know who you are. So identifying who you are is really important. But earlier you gave many different identifications of who you were. And in some of the conversation, it was you were talking about white people and the need for white people and people of color, but mainly you mentioned a Black person at the time and how you grew up, you know, with that white-Black dichotomy there. And so I just wanted to bring back the understanding that you may be white and you grew up white, but you have an Asian American daughter who allows you to somehow put your foot into another shoe, the shoe of another culture.
That's an accurate identity
culture in America. And so you're not really of one identity. And I think that's wisdom in a sense, recognizing we are all one. When we talk about humanity, we're all one. And I it's so interesting because I love to get into politics. And recently on one of the networks, I won't say it because I want, but you might, those people who are into politics might understand. They were saying how when you are of one persuasion, you tend to negatively identify with the other, but then you are doing the exact same thing that you're accusing others of doing by not looking at the other person as normal or making sense or as having the right to have their opinions. So I think when you share the information about your daughter and how you care as a parent, you can liken it to an African-American mom.
I can.
And this is May's Mother's Day. So May's Mother's Day. May is the month where Mother's Day is recognized and celebrated. So there are very famous Black moms now who have formed a group, a union, because of their sons and daughters being murdered by people, officers of the law, when they're doing illegal acts.
So I know that there's been blood on the streets.
So you're feeling that type of understanding and awareness in a sense.
I have a sensitivity that's more deep now than I would have had if I didn't have a Chinese daughter. But I think people are moving in the right direction. I think people are beginning to get awake to what might be possible. The younger generations are moving there. Anyway. They're there much more than the older generations if you look up the scale. I think it's all okay. I think you're getting them, as I said, I think things are moving. They're not moving as fast as you like. They never do. Glacial speed. But man, the changes I've seen in my lifetime are pretty dramatic. They are pretty dramatic.
Well, let me ask you a question about wisdom. And I'm going to go back in history. And you might know some of these people from those moments. Maybe not personally. But those moments that you were able to see it on TV or hear it on the radio or read it in the newspapers and magazine articles. But there was a time when Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't so lauded as he is today. And certainly even when he began his quest to help Black Americans and poor Americans, working class Americans. There was another person who it seems that the media certainly, and many African Americans who didn't see him as a proper leader, Malcolm X, they were working towards for the right message, but in very different ways, I should say. But one of them, when Malcolm, he said he went to Mecca and he saw all of these other people who were looking different than him as his brother. So I want to ask you, going back to the term wisdom, is that what is really necessary for us to reach the mark that Martin Luther King was talking about when we see each other, when we see ourselves in each other? And then not as one to be feared, but as one to be loved. Is wisdom love, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Here's what I want to, two things I want to say. One is I read the biography or autobiography of Malcolm X a long time ago. It changed my life. So it was like very impactful that someone would have the heart to never back down from their stand. I thought, wow, that is, and give their life for that. And it was intimate. And so for me, it was a life-changing experience. And I think you got to get to know people on a personal level. And I think once you get them on a personal level, it's not the same thing. It's not you over there. It's you're sitting right here. And I don't think we're doing enough of that. I don't think we have a structure for fulfillment in its capacity to actually be done on that kind of level of intimate basis. But that would begin to change the the foundational pieces here. You know somebody, get to know, be with people, see what that would be like. Set that up. It's not, you know, it would be an experience for you to relate to someone unlike your a stereotype. What would that be like for you? So there are things that you said from the very beginning of this call about reflection. I mean, if you, I can be and sit and talk with you for an hour and have these kinds of deep and fully self-expressed conversations where you get to be who you are in the world, trying and actually doing, making that kind of difference. And I can be who I am, not embarrassed, and just be fully who I am with you. This is kind of remarkably good, you know. You don't have a skin color now. You're my friend.
Yes, we are.
Yes, that's exactly, you know, how it works out.
Or an age, because I fill you with ageism. I think, you know, that too.
You know, I know, but I still think I'm sexy at the gym. So I'm sorry.
Well, I still think I'm 18. No. Well, I want to bring up the fact again with this being Asian Awareness Month that, you know, one thing about age in different cultures in China, they mm-hmm. in China and Japan, they see people who are older as more viable, in fact, and they really look to them as an important cultural group.
I've spent time with a Native American tribe frequently spent time with the elders. The elders are listened to in a different way. They're held differently. They're seen differently. They participate differently. They don't get old. They get healthy die, but they're pretty good. And yeah, there are places where the elders have, getting older doesn't mean you're going to become an elder, by the way. Uh-huh. So there's a difference here. And, you know, I spent my time with really amazing elders all over the planet. And I always get something. I never leave the same. I walk in. There's always something I take away out of being with people of wisdom like that. And maybe I gain a little more wisdom myself. I think there's some wisdom missing here in our culture. I think there's wisdom missing certainly in our politics. There's wisdom missing everywhere. There would be more love and compassion and caring and, you know, more ease and grace and more, hey, man, just slow down a bit here. There'd be your grandfather telling you, hey, just take it easy here. You know, we're getting there. So I think we have to end on the hour. That's what I believe. So I've really seen this as an opportunity for myself. It's another way, it's like coming out of the closet a bit. It's really very cool. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Mark Cooper, I want to leave. Usually I like to leave with a song, but I have to admit that I like what you stated. So I think we can end that way. But I want to make sure that people, if they want to converse with you at all, are you on social media?
I don't use Facebook. My company does. So they said, I'm sure you can go to there. I have 3 Facebooks that I never look at. So go do what you like there. I think it's a nuisance. Where I spend most of my time is on LinkedIn, because I'm dealing in a professional entity and I don't need to see pictures of their dogs.
Dr. Mark Cooper?
Now, if you're in business and, you know, or you want to start, if you want to talk to me about, seriously talk to me, and you have some entity that can actually make a difference, you know, do something about what we're talking about here.
We have 1 minute, Mark. What's the LinkedIn?
It's www.drmarkb.com. Cooper, COOPER.com, www, whatever I said,
Dr. LinkedIn, Mark Cooper. Dr. Mark B. Cooper. Wonderful. Thank you so much. You've been a pleasure. I enjoyed